Welcome to the Impact Equals podcast, in which we explore the impact investment industry, what it is, why it matters, and how it is playing a key role in reshaping how business is undertaken in many parts of the world. My name is Andrew Murray Watson. African economies create 3 million new jobs a year. That sounds impressive, but to keep pace with the continent's rapidly growing and young population, it needs to create 1 million a month. That's over 30,000 jobs per day, every day, including Christmas. Today, I'll be talking to someone who is tasked with working out how to create the additional 9 million jobs per year that the continent needs. Dr. Frank Aswani is a chief executive of the African Venture Philanthropy Alliance, a network of investors who are collaborating to increase the flow of capital into social investments across Africa, ensuring it is deployed for maximum social impact. Frank has extensive experience in both private and social sectors. He spent 14 years with Eli Lilly, a global Fortune 500 pharmaceutical business, working in Kenya, England, Switzerland, and South Africa. Other roles include VP and Director of Strategic Relations for the African Leadership Academy in Johannesburg, and African Regional Director for International Children's Charity, ARC. A Kenyan national currently living in Johannesburg in South Africa, Frank is a passionate pan-African citizen who believes Africans should be at the forefront of solving their own problems. Firstly, Frank, welcome to the Impact Equals podcast. It is great to have you with us today.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Can we start with a little bit about your personal background? What inspired you to move into the social impact space?
Life has a way of putting you in places that expose you to things that kind of make you have a different view. So as a young person, when I left Kenya to go and work in the UK, I saw that as my exit visa from the continent. I was kind of tired of the difficult situations in which I grew up. My father had just died. I'd inherited four brothers and a mother to take care of. And I thought, wow, you know, at 24, I need to do something different. And I was earning the equivalent of £250 at that point in time. When I left and I went to England, I arrived in Gatwick on a cold morning, stayed in a hotel for 3 weeks, moved into my neighborhood 3 weeks later at a house with three bedrooms, and I got an Audi A4, and I thought to myself, okay, I've arrived now. And then as I sat through my first 3 weeks in the UK, I actually realized, no, England doesn't need me. There's enough people in England to do what England needs. And I started questioning, why am I thinking of staying here? And very quickly, my mindset and passion for the continent started growing. And that really made me question my sense of purpose around what can I do differently. And it drove me to my point, to the point where I'm at right now. So if you go to my Twitter page, I have a line that reads, would it matter on my deathbed that I was born and raised in Africa? Would it matter? And that's kind of led my journey and passion for this continent. I've completely fallen in love with this continent. Having come back from Europe, I then ran businesses for my company, then Eli Lilly, in 27 African countries. And it really gave me a depth of exposure to this continent. And I realized the problems that we have to be solved by us, because we've lived the problems, we've got to live the solution. And that's kind of how I find myself in this space.
I want to come on to that last point you just raised about Africans doing it for themselves. But just first, could you just tell me a bit about AVPA, its mission, and what exactly is venture philanthropy? Because I suspect to a few people who haven't heard of the term before, it might appear a bit of a contradiction.
Yeah. So let me start, Andrew, by telling you the problem we're trying to solve. The problem we're trying to solve is, how does Africa mobilize a kind of capital to help us meet our SDG financing gaps? That stands at about $500 million to $1.2 trillion, depending on who you talk to. And this is so important because we are a continent of plenty of potential, but at risk of missing out a lot of those, especially when you think about the youthful population that we carry on this continent. Our average age is 19. Compared to the UK, Europe, and Japan, China, who are all above 45, we are arguably the youngest continent in the world. And it would be a tragedy if we don't provide a space and environment for young people to really grow and unleash the capabilities and potential that they could possess. And so what AVPA is trying to do is to ask ourselves, how do we help mobilize the kind of capital that will be required to create the desired change to improve the quality of living of Africans, and taking lessons from the past in that process. And one of the biggest issues I think we are facing in the continent that really needs a mind to drive a mindset shift is our traditional processes and thoughts in which we have used to achieve social impact, especially our dependency on aid and government funding, are under huge pressure. We've seen aid to Africa get cut. President Trump in his last couple of years cut USAID funding. The UK government has cut its international development budgets. And those two being the biggest pots of aid coming to Africa has had huge impact, especially on your what we call public goods sectors, healthcare and education. And of course, COVID has added insult to injury in that process.
Africans doing it for themselves. You mentioned the SDGs and the vast sums of money that are needed to meet those development goals. When we always talk about the SDGs, we always hear about how much the developed nations of the world are going to give to Africa. You know, what is the quantum of the sums that are required? We don't hear much about what African nations can bring to the table. Why is that, do you think?
Because I think we are not conscious of the narrative and the reality of changing times. So this is the reality. The world needs $4.3 trillion to solve the SDGs. Africa, as I said, needs about 1.2 of that every year. And if you think about that, we don't have enough. I mean, Africa gets something like under $50 billion of aid a year. Contrast that to how much we need, it's nothing. So the model of achieving social impact has to change. And one of the things we've got to be deliberate about doing is bringing the private sector into the impact discussions. Private financial and capital markets are at about $450 or $430 trillion. We just need 1% of that globally to solve our SDGs. Okay, so we've got to start thinking about how do we make the issue of social impact and social development not just a development agenda conversation, but a conversation for all of us, including the private capital players and private sector players on the continent. And more so, how do we mobilize local private capital? We know even if we were to depend on international private capital, it comes with its risks, you know, devaluation and so on and so forth. So we're best placed to solve this problem using local private capital. But that is not a site that many of our private players, for example, or even governments, or a narrative that we promote actively on the continent. But this is a good point in time for us to really change the narrative on the continent to say, how do we, in essence, catalyze for crowding in more local private capital into these spaces? Local private players have a better understanding of local context. They have a better understanding of local challenges, and they can be the leaders in converging profit and purpose on the continent.
African sovereign wealth funds, where they exist, tend to invest in government bonds, don't they? They don't invest in venture capital opportunities. They don't invest in infrastructure projects on the continent. What do you need to do to change that mindset? Because it seems to me that the sovereign wealth funds, another source of capital in Africa, could act as a catalyst to bring in international financing.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you think about it, Andrew, we're not short of capital. We're short of risk capital more than anything else. Risk capital to fund early stage growth ideas, small businesses really that are creating jobs. Because if you think about, and you're absolutely correct, I mean, how do we close that 9 million annual job deficit? It's not going to come from the corporate sector. It'll come from small businesses. And these small businesses not only create jobs, but they offer a service to our communities and societies. So in many ways, they deliver more than just jobs in their existence. And we need to figure out especially how do we create more risk capital. And a big chunk of that is to start thinking about where do we get this risk capital from? And most of it would come from either philanthropy, aid, or surprisingly enough, governments. Governments in many countries are the biggest grant makers. And they need to think differently about the role that they play. One of the things that I think that is still holding us back in this transition is just unconscious incompetence. We don't know what we don't know. There's a lot of lack of awareness around the need for the evolving role of or aid of philanthropy that sits in the continent. It's very little, to be honest with you. It's not much. But we need to move from that mindset of, as a government, I've got $1 million, I need to deploy $1 million. I should be start asking myself, how can I make each of these dollars leverage and crowd in $5, $10, $20 of additional capital? That way we can deliver a magnifier or multiply effect to the little risk capital that we possess on the continent. And that means we need to grow this whole concept of catalytic investing and catalytic capital. And sadly, it also requires us to then acquire the necessary knowledge to be able to make that transition. And that's one of the challenges we face on the continent. If you think about, I don't know if you know this, Andrew, but the whole continent of Africa has only one institution of learning that teaches impact and sustainable finance as a formal program. 54 countries, we are arguably the world's largest impact opportunity, and we have one university that teaches that subject. It's shocking and embarrassing, to be honest with you, and unacceptable. So, University of Cape Town in South Africa. That's in the absence of impact competent human capital, people who understand how to play in this innovative financing space, where we're bridging traditional philanthropy and private capital and playing in this middle space of impact investing, innovative finance, we are left to stick to what we've always done. And that is a problem. If we can elevate the knowledge and know-how of our people and decision makers in this space, we can vastly improve what Africa stands for in the impact space. So I'll give you an example. I think 10, 20 years ago, would have been largely embarrassed by the number of and diversity of challenges on the continent. Today, those are phenomenal impact opportunities for us to test new markets, new products, new innovations, new services. But all of that requires catalytic capital and risk capital to fund all of that. So there's no better place to be as an impact player than to be in Africa. This is where you test your new products, new services, new models. And if it works in Africa, it's globally scalable.
But that's not necessarily the view held by Western impact investors, is it? Because most of, or certainly the majority of impact funds get spent in countries, that kind of middle tier of countries, don't they? So India, for example, and the more developed African economies. It doesn't get to those, it's certainly in the same amounts, it doesn't tend to get to those African countries with the most acute development needs.
You're totally correct. And I guess it then questions and begs me to question the ethos of such impact players. Because one of the things you're deliberate about as an impact player, unlike a normal investor, is you are risk-seeking. Okay, you're deliberate about risk-seeking. And you are seeking not only the largest amount of additionality in your impact, okay, but you're also being very deliberate about the intentionality of your actions. Now, when you look at all of that, where do you think you can have the largest amount of additionality of your impact? Or where, in the extreme circumstances, can you be really intentional in driving capital where private capital on its own would not go if you're not playing in Africa?
Just going back to the nature of venture philanthropy, you know, we tend to think of philanthropy as giving money out with no expectation of it necessarily coming back. And certainly the concept of philanthropy for profit is something that doesn't sit comfortably with a lot of organizations, and particularly those who in the grant aid space. Do you find it's a challenge to kind of move people to a way of thinking that, within a sort of an African context, that actually investment should be the kind of the primary method of solving some of these development issues?
Andrew, that's a great question. So a big conversation I have with philanthropists today is to try and shift some big mindsets. I think two big things we've got to shift. Amongst traditional development players, we've got to change the mindset that that sector can only absorb grants. And on the extreme of private players, we need to change the mindset that players have, or private capital players have, that to play in the development space means you lose money, that you can't do well and do good at the same time. Those two extreme mindsets we've got to shift. Now, in the context of philanthropy, one of the things I ask people today is, when you're going to fund a project as a philanthropist, try and ask yourself, this project I'm funding, does it have potential to generate some revenue so that it can be self-sustaining? And if you think about it, the people you're serving, is there a willingness to pay and an ability to pay? Let's not assume that everyone we're serving out there is unwilling to pay or is unable to pay. And just because people are paying for a service does not mean it's exploitative. There's a lot of people building really good businesses, companies like MCorpa, that are profitable and offering affordable services that are structured to meet the income generation patterns of the people that they're serving. Okay, MCorpa, for example, uses a pay-as-you-go daily payment system because a lot of people they serve are daily wage earners. And I just think you just need to have some understanding of and cultural intelligence of the space in which you're operating and the people that you're solving problems for. So in essence, I think as we think about this concept of philanthropy, for me, philanthropists need to start asking themselves about not just how much money we're giving, but how sustainable are the investments we're making? And what is the most sustainable ways for us to make sure that our dollar gives a sustainable impact? The minute you find yourself, and some situations, I agree, some projects just require philanthropy, like if you're doing an old people's home or something like that, that's fine. But in some cases, we haven't challenged ourselves enough to ask, are there market-based solutions behind what we're funding that could then make us just be catalytic investors in the early stages of that enterprise or that investment in a manner that we can just get it on its feet and it can grow on its own?
Do you understand why some people think that profit is just something that, you know, should not be part of the development equation?
I think it's because they also don't understand the fact that the people you're helping have pride. They want independence. Those same people don't want to be on a crutch for the rest of their lives. That father that you're trying to help, that mother that you're trying to help, wants to be able to one day walk without your help. And that, I think, is a fundamental thing we sometimes forget, that no one wants to depend on other people for life. You, not you, not I. And we need to realize that one of the things we must come and do is not only help, but to enable independence. That's very important for us to think about.
And in that context, how important is it that the investor, at least some of the investment, is African in origin? Because one of it is an accusation leveled occasionally that if all the money is coming from the global north into the global south, you end up with a situation where local populations and local communities don't actually end up with any equity in the solution.
It's very important, Andrew. Listen, we do need help as a continent. There's no question about it. But we are not helpless. And we need to be able to have some skin in the game in all of the stuff that we do. And fundamentally, our skin in the game not only comes from how much money we can put in, but also the know-how of the nature of the challenge we're trying to solve. So there is some non-financial capital that we can bring in as Africans, but there is capital that we can also put in, I strongly believe. And it can come either as in the front end, the risk-taking catalytic capital, or it can come in the follow-on capital that then scales and grows its initiatives to reach more people and serve more beneficiaries. So I strongly believe that should be, because as I've said before, we've lived the problem, we should live the solution. And that is something I think, even for the pride of ourselves as Africans, it's super important that we're able to be part of the process that solves these issues and to be the ones being celebrated and celebrate the joys of our people as they move to better places in their standards of living.
How would you see, in an ideal world, development finance institutions working, and others, impact investors, inward investors into Africa, how would you like to see those institutions working with local partners?
One of the things I struggle with is when I see all these great initiatives being run by development partners, but lack the presence of African partners on the table. I've become a big advocate for making sure that whenever people come from the outside to come and help us, which we greatly appreciate, please also enable us. Have Africans around the table learning how this stuff is being done so that you just don't leave us with projects that have been done, but you leave us with the know-how to maintain those projects and grow them after you've left. I think that is important. Secondly, in the context of declining aid to the continent, I think the aid community could do a really great job of helping us now build human capital on the continent that understands this innovative finance impact investing space and help us really become better players at working to crowd in private capital into the impact space. I don't think enough is being done to fill the vacuum that is being left behind by the declining aid and the receding presence of global finance institutions. When I look at DFIs, for example, I think DFIs haven't done justice to the continent. I think DFIs were supposed to come in and plug this hole between aid and private capital. But right now, a lot of DFIs are probably seeking as much market rate returns as private capital players. which really doesn't help us in many ways. And I understand that they've got shareholders they need to please. Then if that is the case, don't call yourself a DFI. Just come and invest like anyone else, and we shall be good with it. Okay. I strongly think that aid agencies in particular, those with philanthropic capital or aid, how are you being catalytic? How are you helping Africa build the foundational pillars of sustainable impact on the continent? How are you helping us build institutions that can support impact in the long term? How are you helping us build human capital? How are you helping us build practices? How are you helping expose us to ways of working that we're not aware about? So you come and set up a blended finance vehicle or whatever, have a seat on the table for a couple of Africans to come and sit to understand how blended finance vehicles work. How are you helping our universities to become better at teaching this subject? Because the minute we can get more young people in Africa exposed to this kind of stuff, the better. I mean, Andrew, I'll give an example. If you went to Oxford to do an MBA, you'd do a module on impact investing. There's hardly any African university that offers that. Those kind of things, I think, are fundamental to Africa's sustainable development, and not necessarily about throwing more money at the continent, but how do we build the building blocks, and how are we more deliberate about making sure that it's the people who will drive the change, and how we are we building the right people in that process, and taking lessons learned, but also recognizing that Africa is very unique. What are we learning or helping Africans learn about themselves? What are we testing and experimenting on the continent that gives us unique insights into how problems in Africa can be solved differently in this new context and framework of innovative finance, for example?
Just building on that point about what impact actually means at a local level, because from a sort of a top-down approach, from a sort of a DFI perspective or another impact investor perspective, there's very complicated metrics in terms of what impact means, how it's measured, and so forth. And you mentioned that for Africa to create those 9 million extra jobs a year, it's going to come from SMEs, it's going to come from community organizations and smaller businesses. But presumably for those smaller businesses, the understanding of what impact is presumably revolves primarily around creating jobs and creating services for those communities. How is impact defined at that local level? How should it be defined?
Yeah, I think at that local level, yes, you think about that. And if you think about it, every business delivers impact, but not every business is impact investing. And I come back to the differences that I always use in defining that is the additionality and intentionality. So if you're going to set up a factory in Kenya or in South Africa, it's a big difference whether you build that factory in Nairobi or Johannesburg vis-a-vis build it in the rural areas of those two countries and create jobs where they're most needed. And I always say, in the aspects of intentionality, is private capital being incentivized or is it going to places where on its own it would not go? Because that's where the biggest need is. If you think about small businesses, if we can make small businesses a rural construct as well, not just an urban construct, then we start creating jobs in rural areas and not having everyone come into the cities to live in cramped places and work for very menial amounts of money when they could actually have a very good quality of life living in rural areas and working from rural areas. And those are the things I think we need to think about. But we've got to provide some of the incentives to ensure that some of these businesses and jobs are being created where they're most needed. And that's where this is the difference between impact investing and some of the mainstream investing. But some of what we're trying to do is how do we mainstream impact investing? How do we make sure that 5-10 years from today, when we're making decisions around investments, are we applying an impact lens and being deliberate about being able to not only convert profit and purpose? And I'm not saying at all that we compromise on the financial returns, because I do appreciate that money is seeking returns as well. But the construct that we, in doing impact, we necessarily have to lose money is a fading construct. So how do we mainstream 5-10 years from today that we're deliberate about making sure that we question whether we're doing the right thing on that context? How many of our suppliers are women, for example, in a continent where there's so many unemployed youth? How many of our suppliers are young people's businesses under the age of 30, for example? In thinking about the programs that we're working with to fund on skills development, through our CSI programs, how many of these are going to support programs in high schools that are enhancing entrepreneurship, for example? That kind of stuff we've got to be a lot more deliberate about. And it's less about compliance. It's more about commitment to the impact journey.
You know, we're talking about, if you're coming back to this figure of needing to create 9 million extra jobs a year. It's a bit of a fast-moving train, isn't it, the African economy? I mean, do you have time to be so considered and so methodical about, you know, the ways that impact capital is deployed? I mean, there's an urgency here, isn't there, to deploy more capital rapidly?
Andrew, we are so late. We're so late. And we are really at a turning point. In 2050, we could have Africa provide at least half of the labor to the world. Or we could have Africa add another 100 million people to the poverty numbers. It's our choice. It's our choice. It all depends on what we do now. But we do not have the luxury of time. There's never been a time when we need more urgency to address some of these issues than today. And we don't have time. Okay? I look at my kids every day.
Is that recognized by those arenas where it needs to be recognized?
Sadly not, because you're not seeing the sense of urgency to address these issues. Look at our education system, for example. We're running an education system that is producing job seekers. It's the same education system my parents went through. If your education system is supposed to be fit for purpose, we should have had every African student at least being exposed to an entrepreneurship program. And now, recognizing that not all of them are going to become entrepreneurs, but even the skills that they learn in an entrepreneurship program makes them much better problem solvers. Should they go into corporates or add any other venture that they choose to go into? But we need to make entrepreneurship aspirational and celebrated on this continent. It's like you going to a doctor who knows you have cancer and they're giving you vitamin pills. You know, we're failing our kids. We're failing our future generation in taking them through an education system that we know has 9 million deficit of jobs out there that these kids are going to walk into. And they've trusted us as the older generation to do something about it, and we've done nothing. So I strongly believe we've got to do something different. We've got to do something drastic. We've got to take some big risks. And we've got to commit some big resources towards some of these issues.
Given the scale of the challenge, as you've just outlined, do you wake up in the morning with a sense of optimism that those changes are happening and are possible? Or do you sort of want to bury your head and just go back to bed?
Now, Andrew, so this is the joy of being in this space, is you're a perennial optimist. And you're a perennial optimist who lives to always be thinking about what we did yesterday is not working for the problem we're facing tomorrow. So what do we need to do? You're a perennial optimist who is willing to try out different things and carry with you people who have the same mindset. So every day I wake up and I think, as an impact player, as someone who's building an impact ecosystem on the continent and leading a group, a network of impact investors and other players, what are we doing differently today to solve tomorrow's problems? What are we experimenting differently today to solve tomorrow's problems? How are we inspiring different people to come into this space? How are we providing the conducive environment to help people who are in this place do what they need to do better, faster, cheaper? That's what we live for every day. And the glass, I think, for me, especially in the advent and the growing of impact investing, is no longer half empty, it's half full. And as I say, the continent of Africa offers the most exciting impact opportunities for people to solve global problems, because we have diverse problems, which are exciting impact opportunities. We have a growing youth population that can be a good workforce to drive some of these innovations. And we have players who are now willing to partner and to come together to do some of this stuff as a collective in trying to find and map, chart out a better path for the continent. But it's hard work. It's hard work. And sadly, Andrew, some of the right things to do are hard. And we should be brave enough to make sure that we are facing some of these challenges with courage, with enthusiasm, with optimism, and with a mindset of making sure that we're learning as a collective, and where we can help each other, we should. And the reality is, in many cases, the joy about this is also that if you're solving for a problem on one part of the continent, someone somewhere is doing the same somewhere else. How do we bring you together? How do we connect you? That kind of stuff is what we need to do a lot more deliberately. But there's never been a more exciting time to be an impact player on the continent. And that's why I love what I do, because there's upside in every morning when I wake up. I look and I think, I celebrate young African entrepreneurs. I celebrate innovators. And in places where you never thought there'd be opportunities to solve problems sustainably, profitably, people are doing it. And we're proving to the world that even that poor African who we, a couple of years ago, we called him a statistic because he earned less than $1, is a big business opportunity for someone. And the people building massive businesses on the back of that population on the continent.
I could very well easily end on that wonderful note of optimism, but I just want to ask you one last question. And it's a question that we ask all our guests. What are the kind of the three things to look out for over the next few years in the impact investment industry? What are going to be the big defining trends?
I think, let me tell you the things we're trying to influence, and actually that would probably answer the question. One is the growth of impact competent human capital. We need people who understand this space to grow this space. And right now we don't have enough. So we at AVP are working on a program to try and make sure that in the next 3 years, we have at least 50 African business schools teaching the subject of impact and sustainable finance on the continent. That way we can do everything at scale locally. We can train local players. We can do case studies. We can do policy support for governments, so on and so forth. And I strongly believe in the next 10 years, if anyone in the world wants to learn about impact, they should be coming to Africa. We should be the Wall Street of impact in the world. People should be coming to us to understand how to do this stuff, kind of stuff. So that's the first thing. The second thing I think we shall see emerging and growing is the growth of risk or catalytic capital. As I mentioned earlier, the world is not short of capital, we're short of risk capital. And if we go to unlock private capital to come into this space, to de-risk social investments, we need large amounts of risk capital. And we're seeing trends now of people wanting to come together to deliver multiplier effect through moving from traditional philanthropy to catalytic investing. The difference being, they just ask themselves, for every dollar I put in, how am I unlocking $2, $3, $4, $5, $10 of private capital? How am I supporting investor readiness of early stage businesses, for example, so they can attract more follow-on capital? So that's another big trend that I think we shall see. The third trend I think we shall see is mainstreaming of impact in a lot of places. We've seen corporates now, many of them starting to look at things like embedding SDGs into their strategies. We've seen a lot more people being a lot, LPs, whether they're DFIs or family offices, or seeking more than just financial returns from the money they're putting in. And those kind of things I think we shall see a lot more of. And I'm particularly keen to follow in Africa, the corporate path and what they're going to do about the SDGs, because corporates are a big contributor to the African economy. And if they can mainstream the SDGs and make them come alive, like the example of Safaricom, who have done a phenomenal job in that space, they can be leaders in transforming how business is done on the continent.
Thank you so much for your time. It's been fascinating and uplifting listening to what you have to say. Thank you to all our listeners. Until next time.
Thank you.